Of you who are on live stream today, we know that not everybody can gather, and it's fantastic that we still have that mechanism available, but it really is such a joy to gather with the body, so thank you for having us. How strange these last few years have been. Now, to be honest, I don't think any of us, or many of us, saw a pandemic coming. The notion seemed implausible a few years ago. How much has changed and how much more we now know. But the questions still remain, don't they? Why did this happen? Will it happen again? And of course, alongside COVID, we know that our world, as we've just prayed, is experiencing widespread trouble, conflict, environmental disasters. And asking questions in the face of tragic circumstances isn't new. We've done that down through the ages, but usually without satisfactory answers being provided or found. But the theologian Tom Wright challenges us that the best question is not why, but what. What can we do? He reminds us that Christians have always asked this better question in response to crisis, a response modelled to us from the very earliest days of the church and continuing through the very worst of times. In Paul's very first letter, he tells the Galatians to do good to all people, and Christians and the outside world couldn't believe it then. In his book, The Rise of Christianity, the author Rodney Stark makes a compelling case that the way Christians behaved in the great plagues in the early century, for instance, was a significant factor in contributing to the spread of the faith. And ever since, of course, Christians have visited the prisoners, cared for the wounded, welcomed strangers, and fed the hungry. Now, the aftermath of the global pandemic is far from over, particularly for the most fragile and vulnerable parts of our world. There are significant other crises confronting us: hunger, food insecurity, and even famine right at this moment across the Horn of Africa, conflict in Myanmar, war in Ukraine, the economic crisis in Sri Lanka. And of course, even before these crises, we know that there is very real inequality, injustice, and poverty in our world. There always has been. But does it follow that there always will be? Well, I don't believe so. I truly believe that there is another way. And the questions I have for us today and for every person who calls themselves a follower of Jesus are these. What is our role? What does God expect of us? What are we going to do? What are we doing to be at work with God today? Now, I'd love to take us on a bit of a journey with this, but let me start right at the beginning with Jesus. We know that one of the marks of the Christian life is serving, and that Jesus modelled a life of service, culminating, of course, in his ultimate act of service when he gave up his life on the cross. Now, just a day earlier, you'll remember that Jesus and his disciples had celebrated the Passover feast together, and that Jesus, during the meal, got up, took off his outer clothing, and he wrapped a towel around his waist. He poured water into a basin and he began to wash and dry his disciples' feet. Now picture Jesus kneeling at the feet of these men. These were dirty, dusty, smelly feet. At first they protested, but Jesus insisted because he wanted to leave them a very clear picture of not just who he was, but who he wanted them to be as his followers. As Jesus served us, so we are called to serve others. And we know that one of the most important things we can do as people of faith is to live a life that serves others. Here's what Jesus had to say. "Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." Now, when I was 21, I went forward in a tiny little chapel and I gave my life to Jesus. I hadn't grown up in a Christian family. I hadn't had that blessing. But I knew in those moments that if I accepted Jesus, he would forgive my sins. He would take away the guilt and the shame that I was carrying, and he would be my friend right through life. And eventually, yes, Jesus would take me to be with him. And making the decision felt absolutely wonderful, and it was gloriously just about Jesus and me in those moments. And I can imagine that many of you can identify with my experience. For me, the gospel was and is very, very personal. But if that's where it stops, it's not the whole gospel. In fact, in the words of Richard Stearns, a past president of World Vision International, that version of the gospel, the one where it's just about us and Jesus, is a gospel with a hole in it. He said, being a Christian means much more than just having a personal and transforming relationship with God. It also entails a public and transforming relationship with the world. If your personal faith in Christ has no outward expression, then your faith has a hole in it. An awfully big hole. Let me remind you about the very start of Jesus' ministry. When he identified and called his disciples, he didn't say to them, "Follow me and I'll take you to heaven." That's not what he said. He said, "Follow me and I'll send you out. I will send you out to fish for people." Jesus wasn't just calling the disciples into a holy huddle, as much as we love this holy huddle. He was sending them from that. He wasn't just inviting them to follow him. He was inviting them to join his work, to go out into the world and to serve people just as he did. So the gospel isn't just about Jesus and me. It's about Jesus and his mission. It's about Jesus and others, and it's about following him for the sake of others. Now, during my years in ministry, I've been privileged to spend a lot of time in the local church in Indochina, where much of the church is controlled, and Christians are monitored, and church activities have to be registered and approved. And there's no question that the church community risks their comfort, their livelihood, and more to serve their communities and to share the gospel. And harassment is particularly strong in areas where the church is growing. And remarkably, it is growing at an exponential rate, particularly in the rural ethnic minority communities. And of course, this threatens the control of the authorities. And so the persecution of Christians and pastors increases. And it was in a hill tribe ethnic area that I met Pastor Lai. Pastor Lai is a subsistence rice farmer by day and a Bible translator by night. He translates the scriptures into his people's indigenous language. And in every other waking moment, he pastors his church of 888 people from 183 households. And I'm pretty sure Pastor Lai knows every single one of them by name. Now, Lai became a Christian when he was working remotely with a group of men who gathered around a radio and heard about Jesus for the first time on a nightly Christian broadcast. And the whole group of men decided to become Christians together. Right from their very first moments, they understood that Christian faith is not just personal. It is that, but it's more. It's a faith that is best lived out and shared in community. And Lai shared his story with me in these words. "I needed to know the real faith," he said. "I needed to know this was the truth. I love listening to and talking about the word with the other men. I learned a lot, and I began to see that the men in my family didn't have good lives. They drank a lot, and I wanted my life to be different. I did not want to be like father, like son. I wanted to be like my heavenly father. The Bible taught me I need to serve, and I realized my people need me to tell them what is in the Bible so it can change their lives too." Right from the very beginning, Lai understood that his new faith was not just personal and that it meant having a transforming relationship with his own community. Now, a young woman that I mentioned previously, who I met just 3 weeks ago in Nepal, just an incredible privilege. Her name is Suni, and she lives in rural Nepal, many hours from Kathmandu. And now Suni's been participating in a Baptist World Aid Child and Youth Community for Change project, and she's learned powerful truths about equality and human rights. She knows that she's equal to the young boys and the men in her community. You might note that little poster that she's got behind her, that little handwritten poster. Even though that she herself has experienced discrimination, and she's developed her confidence and advocacy skills to the extent that she, along with other group members, are speaking out and working for positive change around those issues. And Suni has recognized that she is strong and that she's capable, she's intelligent, and that she can make important choices for herself, and that together with her friends, they can make a real difference. Now, advocating for against child marriage has been a particular passion for Suni. And recently, she and the group were able to intervene when Suni's own older sister was being forced into a marriage that she didn't want. Now, Suni has taken what she's been given, that learning that she's received, and she's used it for the good and well-being of others. She's feisty, but in a very great way, and she's powerfully advocating for others. And Suni reminds me that God has delegated to human beings the power to run many aspects of this world. And for those of us who follow Jesus, we know that God always calls us to love, to act, and to serve. That's his plan, and there is no plan B. And we know that the world we're called to is broken. You don't need me to tell you that. And current predictions are that the economic progress made in developing countries during the last 3 decades have been pushed so far backwards by COVID that it's going to take another 30 years to catch up. And hundreds of millions of people in the poorest countries may have lost their jobs on a permanent basis. There are over 130 million girls across Asia and Africa who aren't in school, who were before the pandemic, but are unlikely to ever return. 130 million girls out of school who were in school before the pandemic. Now, more than 6 million people have died worldwide. And to bring that closer to home, I wonder whether you know that across the fledgling church, the fledgling Baptist church in Bangladesh and Nepal, over 30 local pastors died of COVID. Now, this is the world that we're a part of. Up to 1 billion people are right at this moment facing acute food insecurity and even famine. And increasingly, this is in countries who would never have contemplated this as a possibility in the past. We've had a glimpse of food security in Australia, food insecurity and scarcity in Australia in the last few years. Who knew toilet paper would become such a valuable commodity? And funnily enough, through that whole crisis earlier this year, when was it that we couldn't buy lettuce? That was only a few months ago, wasn't it? Funnily enough, in my local supermarket, kale was still available, which my husband said just proved his point that it's totally inedible. I personally love kale, but he felt that definitely proved his point. Now, there is no question that the cost of living has made food insecurity a reality for Australian families on the margins too. But across the Horn of Africa, in places like Malawi and Somalia and Ethiopia and Kenya and Uganda, the situation is dire. The rains haven't come for over 4 years now, and the current drought is the worst in living memory. Africa is on the cusp of famine. Now, a combination of drought and conflict since Kabul fell has seen an ever-increasing exodus of refugees from Afghanistan, and they now number in their millions. Even closer to home, more than 1 million Rohingya, Chin, Kachin and Karen have fled Myanmar during the current conflict and find themselves absolutely stateless. 1 million of them live in the largest refugee camp in Bangladesh, in Cox's Bazar, which is just mind-blowing because Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries in the world, and yet they're dealing with the influx of millions of refugees. The conflict in Ukraine has displaced over 10 million people, and with several million of those having poured across borders into Poland and Hungary, Moldova and other bordering countries. No doubt you know that Baptist World Aid has been able to partner with both the Ukrainian and Hungarian Baptists from the very first days of the war, and I have to tell you that they are doing a phenomenal job. Churches right across Ukraine are open, and they're providing safe haven and food and shelter and safe passage to the next town. And the Hungarian Baptists are on the border, and they're welcoming people as they come across, and they're providing them with emergency needs, with warm clothing, with shelter, again with food, and also providing then housing solutions for them, often with locals who come out of the local Hungarian church. And just a couple of months ago, I was able to meet with both the Hungarian and the Ukrainian Baptists. And I felt incredibly humbled that God has enabled us, the Australian Baptist family, through people like you, to respond and support them in their greatest hour of need. And they asked me to thank the Australian Baptist family and to ask you to keep praying for them and to keep being generous. The war continues, as does their incredible and heroic efforts. And when it ends, please God that it does soon, there is going to be an enormous task of rebuilding there, including that Baptist church infrastructure in Ukraine in particular. There's a long way to go if we're to remain faithful to our global Baptist family in Ukraine. But thank you for your support of us there too. So right at this moment, some 95 million people are currently refugees or forcibly displaced by conflict worldwide. At least 35 million of those are children. They are the most vulnerable of all. Now, that means that as we meet here this morning, one in every 95 people on the planet is a refugee or displaced. One in every 95 people on the planet is a refugee or displaced at this very minute. It's shocking, isn't it? It's more refugees than our world has ever seen, ever in our history, including after the World Wars. But alongside that, we know that ours is the wealthiest generation ever. Most of us here live fairly comfortably, and compared to the majority world, we live very well indeed. We are rich by the world's standards, and we're bright, we're educated, and we're experienced. We can travel around the world in under 24 hours, and we can send a message in a millisecond. We have sophisticated research and medicine at our fingertips. We have ample resources. We live in devastating times, but our world does have enough food to feed the hungry and enough resource to house the refugee and the capacity to reach every person on the planet with the gospel. God has given us everything that we need to end physical and spiritual poverty. So why don't we? And whose responsibility is it? Let me personalize that for us and put out a challenge. If we're following Jesus just for our sake, we're not really following him the way that he wants us to. And if we haven't joined him in his work in the world, our lives are too small, and we've settled for making a living when we could be making a difference. The author, Davy Garland, says this: "The call and response of the fishermen should shatter our comfortable world of middle-class discipleship. Disciples are not simply those who fill pews at worship, attend an occasional Bible study, and offer to help out in the work of the church now and then. When one is hooked by Jesus, one's whole life and purpose are transformed." Like it or not, God has delegated the running of many aspects of this world to human beings. This is our privilege and our responsibility as his image bearers. But I wonder if many of us think we don't have enough to offer. In the words of one of my heroines, Baroness Carolyn Cox, you can look her up later, who spent a lifetime working to change the world, she said, "Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something." Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. Now, we had this Bible verse before. Ephesians says, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." So let's be clear. We aren't saved by good works, but we are saved for good works. We aren't saved by good works, but I believe we are saved for good works. And our God is a sending God. And Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." Jesus didn't just announce that the kingdom had come. He demonstrated it. He fed the hungry. He healed the sick. He ministered to the lonely. He included the marginalized. He blessed the children. And he called people back to the Father. And he calls us to do the same. Now, I think a woman called Kumari understands exactly what this means. Again, I met Kumari just 3 weeks ago. She's a participant in one of our community self-help groups in an area that is particularly marginalized by poverty in rural Nepal. And previously, Kumari and her family, alongside the rest of the community, struggled with very basic issues such as not having a clean water supply, having no toilet or any other basic hygiene or sanitary facilities in their homes or in their village. Girls being discriminated against and not being educated and experiencing child marriage, both due to custom and extreme poverty, and very high rates of domestic and family violence. And Kumari told me that she didn't previously leave her home, that she had a very low level of literacy and little or no confidence in who she was or what she could contribute. That's not the woman you see looking at you now, though, is it? Now, Kumari and the other women in her group all have functional literacy and they can sign their own names. They've learnt about their own rights alongside that of their daughters. And they've worked together in recent months to clean up their village. And you can notice the change when you drive into that village, to the surrounding village. It's pristinely clean. And they've implemented environmentally sustainable and healthy practices. And they're also actively promoting social harmony between the two prominent faith groups that live in the village. They're campaigning for and providing incentives for increased school attendance, and they're advocating against domestic violence and child marriage. The village now has its own shared toilet facility. I was very grateful for that. And reports that poor social behaviour, such as excessive alcohol consumption and occurrence of domestic violence, are very rare. importantly, girls in Kumari's community are now all in school. Every single girl in that village is in school, and the whole community understands the importance of girls being educated. Now, Kumari tells me that she dreams of a day where there will be no more child marriage, but she and the other women in the group now know that when they work together and support each other, they have power and capacity. Together, they're changing not just their own lives, but those of their daughters. And this isn't a win for women and a loss for men. Everybody in this village, everybody in this community is flourishing. This is what mutual flourishing is all about. Kumari and her friends are achieving quite incredible goals, and they're continuing to make plans to achieve new ones. And they're the perfect example of what can happen when you believe in yourself and what you're doing. And their faithfulness inspires and convicts me, because you and I were made to make a difference. Our lives were meant to count, and the world should be a better place because of us. Now, each of us has a sphere of influence. Each of us has been called to follow Jesus and to change the world in his name. We may not believe in our own ability to make that difference, but clearly God does. And his challenge to us is to join him in his mission in and to the world. We get a very clear picture of God's purposes early and right throughout the scriptures, but we also quickly understand the ways that humans deal with each other. There is God's consistent and special concern for the poor, the widow, the orphan, the marginalized, and the powerless. But there's also the recognition of those structures and powers that exist in society and within relationships that seek to deny human potential and the possibility of life in all its fullness. And without equality, justice, freedom, and peace, human relationships, rather than being agents of fullness, well, they rob and they steal. What does the Lord require of us personally and corporately? You know the answer to this: to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with him. And at Baptist World Aid, we do see a world where poverty has ended and all people enjoy the fullness of life God intended. We see God's kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven, and we're blown away by the privilege and the responsibility he's given us to partner with him as we usher in a glimpse of his kingdom right here and right now in every corner of the earth. But the reality is that God has given every one of us who calls ourselves a follower of Jesus the responsibility to bring his kingdom to fruition. And when Jesus called his disciples to change the world with him, they were simple fishermen. They were not powerful, influential men. Jesus wanted more for them to just run a business or make a living. He wanted them to make a difference. He wanted to take their ordinary life and turn it into a mission. Anything else was too small a calling, and so it is with us. Now, it's easy to think that God's call is for somebody else. It's for missionaries. It's not for me. But do you know the word missionary is never used in the Bible? Not once. And that's because of God. As God's people, we're all sent. All of us are commanded to go and be ambassadors for Christ. There is no special class of superhero sent ones. So who are you serving? Who are you sharing the whole gospel with? Is the world a better place because of you? Do you make your street or neighborhood a better place? Who are you making a difference for? Will the world be glad you lived? I believe we all need to see and touch the hurt, regardless that we may be carrying some of our own. In fact, sometimes I think the most impactful ministry comes out of broken places and broken people. That's the beauty from ashes that the Bible talks about. And I'm reminded of Jesus' words from Matthew. Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And conversely, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. Now, there is a multitude of good reasons to extend our hands and our hearts, but as Christians, as Jesus followers, there is none more higher than this. When we serve those in need, we are loving him. It's a message Jesus made crystal clear. When we truly love others, when we serve in ways beyond ourselves, we love him best. So there are several billion human reasons to accept God's call and challenge. And Jesus says, follow me and I will send you out. Now we may be ordinary, broken, sinful, but forgiven women and men. But he has called us and he has sent us to make a difference in his name. And I pray that together we will go, not necessarily physically, but certainly in and through the work God calls us to participate in. And that we will dream of, we will work toward, and we will pray for and look forward to a day, to a world where poverty has ended and all people truly enjoy the fullness of life God intended. And in such a world, surely we will all taste the joy of the kingdom of heaven. Let me pray for us.